A decade after DNA evidence tied Sally Hemings to Thomas Jefferson, the history of the Hemings family remains largely unknown. Annette Gordon-Reed sets out to correct that in her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. And as it turns out, the Hemings were a family as complex as America itself, one in which blacks and whites were bound by blood, power, and sometimes affection. W.W. Norton is the publisher, and I'm very pleased to welcome National Book Award winner Annette Gordon-Reed to the show today. Hi, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You say Sally might not have been the most central and compelling figure in the Hemings family. That might have been her mother, Elizabeth Hemings. Why?
Absolutely, because she was the only one who would have known all of the people in the story. Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson, John Wales, all the people who sort of set the scene for the things that I'm writing about. So she sort of overhangs everyone else, and I would love to talk to her if I could.
They were both of mixed race,
yes.
Elizabeth and her daughter Sally.
Yes.
But remained slaves.
Yes, both remained slaves. Slavery went through the mother. If your mother was a slave, then you were enslaved. So part of Sacrum Vontum, the Roman rule, was the rule that Virginia adopted. So no matter what your race was, technically, if your mother was a slave, you were a slave.
And you could be a half-sister to somebody who was your master.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It happened quite frequently.
It happened here, didn't it?
Yes.
Sally was a half-sister to Martha Jefferson?
Yes, to Thomas Jefferson's wife.
What was the dynamic between Martha and her half-siblings?
Well,
was she at all concerned that they were slaves?
Well, we don't have any real sense of what she thought. We do know that when she married Jefferson, she brought all of them to the mountain with her and sort of installed them as the quote-unquote favored house servant. So in some plantation situations, mistresses who were in this situation would sell their siblings or put them out of sight, but she actually had them around her. They were at her deathbed when she died.
And this was something that happened in the dynamic of many marriages. George Washington said he wanted to free his slaves, but he didn't because he didn't want to deprive Martha of them.
Well,
his Martha.
There are lots of Marthas in those days. His particular Martha, he said that the slaves were to be freed as of her death, although some of them were slaves that she owned. But yes, there were a lot of complex reasons as to why people didn't free their slaves. And certainly we'll never know about Martha Jefferson, what she felt about it.
Well, she died before the relationship between Thomas and Sally Hemings began.
Yes, she died in 1782. And so Jefferson goes off to France and is there until 1789. So this much predates that. Sally Hemings was about 9 years old then.
Thomas Jefferson never remarried.
No.
Not because of Sally.
No, not because of Sally. The Hemings family told a story that when they were around the deathbed that Martha Jefferson asked Thomas Jefferson not to remarry. And she was expressed concern about her daughters having stepmothers because she'd had two stepmothers, and we really don't know what her relationship was like with them, but it must not have been very good if she didn't want stepmothers for her own kids.
I suspect that we don't have any way of knowing how the other slaves felt when the Hemingses and similar situations were given favorite status in a plantation.
Well, Jefferson's grandson said that a number of the enslaved people at Monticello down the mountain, as they said, were jealous of the Hemingses and thought that because they had been treated in a favorable fashion. But that was, again, that's Jefferson's grandson saying this, and we really don't have the statements from other people. We know that the Hemings women didn't marry people down the mountain from Monticello, but there were other indications that they did have cordial relations with some of them. So there's sort of a mixed message there on that question.
When you say down the mountain, I've been to Monticello, and they showed me the slave quarters. Those would have been the quarters for the slaves that stayed in the house?
Yes. A Mulberry Row, you were probably going along Mulberry Row, which runs right outside of Jefferson's living areas there on the south side of Monticello. But down the mountain, all along the mountain there, which now is pretty much covered with trees, those were fields, and there was slave housing down there as well. So that's what I mean by down the mountain.
Now, it wasn't all that long ago that the disclosure that Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson had a relationship and a child which came as a shock to everyone. Now we seem to know a heck of a lot. How has that happened?
Well, I would say that in some communities it was accepted more than others. I think people in the black community accepted it because it was so much a part of the lives of so many African Americans. But certainly after my book came out in 97 and then the DNA, which corroborated, you know, gave support to the story that the Hemingses were Jeffersons and not Carrs, which had been the Jefferson family story, people began to pay much more attention to the story. And also I'd have to say that the people at Monticello at the Thomas Jefferson Foundation have really made slavery a part of the experience there. And so once you begin to look at the Hemings as not just in some sort of isolated way, but look at them as part of an institution that the foundation is willing to talk about openly now in ways that they didn't. People who went there 20 years ago said that I didn't go there until I wrote the book, but said that they referred to slaves as servants. I mean, slavery was really hidden, but now there's a whole change in attitude about that, and I think that has furthered the way people view the story.
Of course, there were many Sally Hemingses throughout the institution of slavery. It's mm-hmm. just that in this case, the man involved was one of the presidents of the United States,
yes,
and one of our founding fathers.
Yes, one of the most famous men in history, and so they are a point of focus when other people are not.
Do we know when the affair between Jefferson and Sally Hemings began?
Not exactly. Their son said that when, near the end of their stay, when they were about to come home from Paris to Virginia, Sally Hemings was pregnant, was going to have a baby. So the only marker for any kind of the onset of any kind of relationship would be her pregnancy, which would have happened in 1789, at the end of 1789. But there's no real way to know precisely.
She followed. He went to serve as a diplomat in France, and then she came later as a traveling companion to his daughter, Patsy?
Yes, his daughter, Polly. Patsy was already there. She came along with Polly when she was about 14 years old and lived there for a little over 2.5 years with Jefferson at the Hotel de Langeac.
So she was only 16,
yeah.
And a little over 16 when she became pregnant,
yes,
by Thomas Jefferson.
Yes, she would have been 16 years old and had a baby in 1790 when she would have been 17.
Do we have any evidence that their relationship was consensual?
We have no way of knowing that.
Because you say the word concubine is more fitting to describe their relationship than mistress.
Well, concubine, I mean mistress only in the sense that mistress usually by that time had come to refer to someone who is a sort of second wife type person. A concubine was someone who lived with a man without being married. But you don't really know about the consensual nature of it. She did come home with him when she didn't have to. I mean, she was pretty much, you know, virtually on free soil in France, she and her brother, and she was also not by herself, I should say, as well. And Jefferson promised her a good life and that her children would be freed when they were grown. And so she came back with him. Now, certainly,
she could have petitioned by French law to be free.
Yes, it was really a pro forma thing. Every petition that was filed in the 18th century was granted. And so it was just a matter of getting to the Admiralty Court and saying, you know, I don't want to be a slave anymore.
It was the structure was called the Police de Noir?
Yeah. Well, the Police de Noir was legislation, interesting legislation that was passed to prevent blacks from coming into the country and at all. But once they got there, the Parisians really didn't like the notion of slavery. And so even though they had this hostility to blacks, once they got there, if the person was enslaved, the Parisian Admiralty Court always set them free if they asked for it.
Although you could also, if you were an American, register your slaves, mm-hmm. and then they would be recognized as your slaves?
They would be recognized, but then they still were supposed to be sent home. I mean, there was a difference between what the law said on the books and what the court actually did. Anytime a slave challenged their enslavement, they were freed 100% of the time.
Wasn't this around the time that France started colonizing parts of Africa?
Yes, there were colonies in Senegal, but their crown jewel, of course, would be Saint-Domingue and Martinique and Guadeloupe, their colonies in the Caribbean that made them fabulously wealthy.
Did that affect the French public opinion about race?
It affected the public opinion about, well, there was a growing dissatisfaction with the notion of slavery, but the colonies were really sort of, well, they were the colonies. They were away from the metropole, and the French did not like slavery on their own soil. They didn't seem to have much of a problem with it away, you know, away from their eyesight. You know, France, franc, free, that it means free. And so they thought that having slavery on French soil was anathema to them.
In many places, the mixed race becomes an issue, and the color of the skin, whether it's darker or lighter, becomes an issue. Was that true in France as well?
There was a preference for a greater comfort with lighter-skinned slaves, but it was a strange thing, and the French had these sort of these very interesting quirks and fads. And there was in the late 18th century a fad for having black servants. People wanted a blackamoor as a butler or a maid or so forth. So in a way, it was a twisted sort of thing. It was racist, but it was sort of an idealized, you know, patronizing view of blacks.
And we even see that a century later in Manet's famous painting Olympia, where the woman, the nude woman, is being served by a very dark-skinned black servant.
Yeah, so there's a love-hate relationship or understanding of what race means in France and, well, lots of different places, as a matter of fact.
My guest is Annette Gordon-Reed, who's a professor of law at New York Law School, professor of history at Rutgers University, and the author of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, an American Controversy, editor of Race on Trial, Law and Justice in American History, and co-author with Vernon Jordan of Vernon Can Read, a memoir. Her latest book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, is published by Norton, and it just was awarded the National Book Award. Is the fact that you are both a professor of law and history, does that help you in telling this kind of story?
Well, it helps me with figuring out the legal rules that apply to their lives, but I also think it law helps in terms of problem solving. There's a different approach to problem solving that lawyers have, law professors have, and if you can sort of temper that with the historian's strengths, I think it's a good combination.
Although they were slaves, Sally and James Heming received salaries while they were in France. Why did Jefferson bother to pay them?
Well, he never says. He continues this practice. When he comes back to the United States, whenever he has free people mixed with enslaved people, he pays everybody. And I suspect that it has to do, Jefferson did not like conflict. And if you think about it, if people are in a place where there's an expectation that some people are going to be getting paid and others not, it might cause conflict. But I think in France, he originates this in France probably because people, because he knows that they're free there. He writes that to someone, that if a slave tries to take their freedom here, there's nothing we can do to stop them. So I think this is a way of buying peace and a way of keeping, you know, everybody on an even keel.
Well, he must have offered her something really strong for her to go back with him, other than the fact that she was pregnant with his child. Maybe that was the reason she decided, being a single mother, a black single mother in France, might have been a bit difficult.
Would have been very difficult if she was there with her brother, who seems to have been preparing to stay there. He hired a tutor to teach him proper French grammar near the end there. It would have been tough for the both of them. But you have to remember, and I think I understood this much more so when I was working on the book, how intensely connected the Hemings family, you know, how members were to one another. They named their children after one another. They, in later years, bought the freedom of family members. It would be difficult, I think, to leave your mother and your sisters and brothers behind. If you trusted Jefferson, if she trusted him, and she had seen how he had treated the rest of her family, and she was 16 years old, I mean, that's you know, there's not a lot of experience there. The thought of leaving your family forever for lots of enslaved people was one of the reasons people didn't run away, even in America sometimes.
Other than being sexually attractive to her master, did Sally Hemings have any power in their relationship?
We have no way of knowing. I mean, the power dynamics between males and females in a couple, whatever the law says, are mysterious, and I don't think there's any real way of knowing that. We know that for whatever reason, he remained attached to her for 38 years. I mean, they had seven children. The children are named for his friends and family members. So we don't know what the dynamic was. I mean, certainly on paper, legally, she had no power over him. But we don't know what their feelings were for one another.
Now, seven children is rather difficult to hide. Mm-hmm. And this did become a big issue in the country at the time.
Yes, it did. It was something that was talked about during the 1790s, but really burst onto the public stage in 1802 when James Callender, who had been a friend of Jefferson's, who then turned on him when Jefferson didn't give him a job in the administration, publicized the story in 1802. But before then, there were sort of neighborhood whispers about this, sort of blind items, page six type blind items about, you know, a statesman in Virginia and, you know, his, you know, concubine and things like that.
Well, a number of the founding fathers owned slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Was this the only case we know of where one of them fathered children with his slave? In this case, seven children?
It's the only one that is really documented. I mean, there are stories about George Washington, but that historians dispute because Washington had no children with his wife, who did have children, which doesn't necessarily prove that he was sterile. I mean, but their historians have not accepted that, and there was not any contemporary talk. The difference about the Hemings things is that this is not something that, you know, people in the 1940s or the 20th century started saying about their ancestry. This was something that was talked about before, you know, while the children were infants or small. So, and then there's a story, I think, about James Madison. There's the family that claims descent from James Madison, but that there's been no confirmation of that as of yet. But anything, you know, I'm just saying it's anything is possible, but it's not nowhere near the degree of confirmation in the Jefferson question.
Well, Jefferson was a prolific writer. Did he ever mention Sally in his correspondence or in his journals?
In his memorandum books, he kept a record of all of his transactions in his memorandum book, and he wrote lots of letters as well. He mentions her in the memorandum book. She's mentioned in the farm book. But in letters, I can think of only two letters where he mentions her in passing. But no, he was pretty disciplined about that kind of thing.
And she obviously would not have spoken publicly about their relationship.
No, she did. She did not. Oh, her children, one of her sons talked about it, but it's hard for us to imagine. But the stigma of illegitimacy was a real problem in the 19th century, and it's the, you know, being born or having children out of wedlock was not something that you went around and talked about.
Well, he promised to free them, did he?
Yes.
So even though he didn't free the rest of his slaves, well, he seems to be so ambivalent about blacks and slaves in general, a man who, everybody has pointed out, talked about the rights of man and yet didn't seem to see that as extending to the people who he owned. And at the same time, he obviously had a relationship that had to have some kind of real human connection with Sally Hemings.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a difficult thing. He freed his children. All of the people that he freed were members of the Hemings family. He freed two of Sally Hemings' brothers in the 1790s. I don't think, you know, even though he couldn't have freed them financially, and his creditors owned Monticello, he couldn't have freed very many people. I don't think that he would have been inclined to free all of his slaves anyway.
While he was traveling in Europe, Jefferson described being deeply moved by a biblical painting of Sarah delivering Hagar to Abraham. What was it about that appealed to him?
Well, the supposition always is that you know, he was thinking about his own situation where his wife had brought this family into his life, and now his wife's sister, who was a slave girl, was living in his home at the same time. And he sort of writes this to Mariah Causeway, who, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, she had no idea probably what he was thinking about, but it is a very, very ironic thing for him to have said.
You told an interviewer in the New York Times recently, when it comes to blacks in America, social history has trumped biography. What do you mean by that?
I mean that black people tend to be thought of in terms of a group. When you write a white life, you think of, in novels or in history, when they're talking about people, you think about the actual details of their individual lives. With blacks, there's sort of a general template that is applied, that is placed over the person's life, whether it fits or not. And so it's the social aspect of being black rather than the individual, the inner lives of black people that seems to matter.
So Sally Hemings never really becomes a human being for us. She always becomes a slave, a concubine, the mother of Thomas Jefferson's children. somebody who was denied throughout history, a whole bunch of other things, but not a person.
She's an object. She's an object that's acted upon. I was in Monticello a couple of months ago, and a man giving a talk, and a person said, very honestly but very sheepishly, he said, you know, I was talking about Sally Hemings in Paris, and he said, you know, I never thought of Sally Hemings going anyplace. And I thought that that was interesting. I mean, the conception of a human being who is utterly static.
And has going no to movement. The opera or to dinner somewhere?
Well, I mean, even outside, you know, I mean, it was this notion that she is just this static, she's like an armoire, she's not moving, a person not in motion. And in history, of course, you want to see people in motion, and she was in motion. And that's what I try to do in the book.
Well, she must have had a sense of agency, and yet we've denied her that in thinking about her.
Yes, because out of the concern of minimizing the horror of slavery, but the two are not mutually exclusive. Obviously.
Although she probably saw more of the world than an awful lot of white people back in the colonies.
Absolutely. She never went anywhere except to London, to Abigail Adams' homes, to Paris, to, you know, the French countryside.
There are a lot of mixed-race people in this country. Do you think that some of them are unaware that that this sort of thing happened in their among their ancestors?
Well, I think, well, black people are aware. I think if to the extent that you mean whites who are mixed race who don't know it, there are lots of whites who are in that category. Certainly members of the Hemings family, the Esten Hemings line that went into the white community, members of their family did not know that they were related to Sally Hemings until the 1970s. But this is something that's ever present in the black community. We go to if you go to a black family reunion, black people are all the colors of the rainbow. And the older the black people are, the lighter skinned they tend to be. So this is something that is present in many black families. So I think we're aware of it all the time.
One thing that's interesting is that Thomas Jefferson defended a mixed race man who was an indentured servant.
Mm-hmm. Who filed a freedom suit. And Jefferson took the case on pro bono. Didn't get a chance to really present the case because the judge cut him off and he lost because he was arguing basically on the words that he would use in the Declaration of Independence and lost the case, and then he gave the guy some money and the guy ran away.
Now, you just won the National Book Award, as I've mentioned a couple of times. Didn't you get it on your 50th birthday?
Well, we didn't have to bring this up, Leonard.
Why? I think that would be very exciting.
That's on any birthday.
I can't think of any birthday present that would be more exciting
birthday.
Than winning that.
Yes. But any birthday. But no, it was nice getting it on any birthday. People asked
on
me.
On your 39th birthday.
On the 11th anniversary of my 39th birthday, yes. No, it was wonderful.
And congratulations for that.
Thank you.
The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, is published by Norton. My great thanks to Annette Gordon-Reed for having me stop by today.
Thank you for asking me.